Okay, well, the topic that I wanted to touch on tonight, to explore together, is one that arose from a retreat experience that I just finished having. I was at about a 5-day long retreat at the Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Marin County, California, the 13th through the 18th of this month. And it was a kind of LGBT, et cetera, retreat. It was for people who were gender non-conforming. Sometimes I think of, you know, gender identity and sexual orientation, they're related, but they're distinct, you know. One is who you feel yourself to be. In my case, gender fluid, a straight gender fluid male, who has, you know, pretty strong feminine aspects to my psyche and whatnot, as well as the male ones. And life for me is basically, I'm kind of right in the middle of that yin-yang symbol, you know, a dance along the border between the two. And then sexual orientation, who you're drawn to physically, who you're physically attracted to. And sometimes I think about those as kind of like an X and a Y axis that defines this sort of big playground. And some folks only play on the swings, and some only on the merry-go-round. Folks like me are, you know, we kind of mosey around. But the one of the things that was so powerful and so moving about the retreat is it was a gathering of those of us who, by reason of gender identity or sexual orientation, are different. You know, feel ourselves to be different from mainstream gender-conforming culture. There's also quite a high percentage of people, you know, a third to a half maybe, who are also not European American. A lot of Asian Americans, Latin Americans, African Americans, right? Who, in addition to situations around gender identity and sexual orientation, also have lived much of their lives also feeling kind of othered, sort of different out of the mainstream and having been treated differently by reason of that. And so it was this really powerful opportunity for us to come together in a place where we didn't feel different, right? Which was a real powerful place of refuge, safety. You know, it's only in queer-friendly, safe spaces that I feel like I can really let down, relax, and be who I fully am. And happily, the Sangha is another such place. And I wondered when I first got there, you know, wow, you know, but where am I? It's really kind of like not in Kansas anymore, you know, or even Denver. But it was also delightful and freeing. And from time to time, we would have these sharing circles where we'd get together and just talk about what the nature of our experience was on this retreat or elsewhere with the difference. And there was this woman sitting next to me, an African-American woman, just a few years younger than me. And she said, well, I found myself really questioning, really wondering what I was doing here. And then I looked out the window, and I saw Lloyd in his long blue dress, and he looked at ease and happy and as free as a bird. And I thought to myself, that's why I'm here. So, that's why I'm wearing this dress. Because it really, you know, it really warmed my heart to hear her say what she did. So it was a setting in which we were not simply accepted for who we were, but appreciated and supported as well. And it really touched me, and it really got me to thinking as well, you know, because for so much of the time of my life when I was in the closet, I was basically terrified of myself, you know, I was afraid of my difference, and that as much as anything else kept me from being really sort of open and free. And it was eventually feeling that for the sake of my own well-being, my own health, mental health, you know, I really did have to come to be able to make peace with that difference and to own it and to say, yes, this is who I am. And it's wonderful when I can be with others who have also experienced that otherness and difference and then support each other. And we live most of our lives in a world where that isn't necessarily the case. I think many of us, regardless of our sexual orientation, gender identity, ethnic lineage, or other factors, have ways that inside we feel ourselves to be different. And because of the way we're treated in broader society, we're disinclined to be open about and owning of whatever those differences happen to be. And those can be a real source of suffering, you know. They can be a source of suffering for the ways that we choose to somehow hold back ourselves, you know, not come forth to be who we are. And they can certainly, by virtue of how we're treated in a broader society, and here I'm speaking, you know, not only in terms of sexual orientation, gender identity, but across the spectrum of ethnic lineages in our society, you know, the means by which our institutions, our social institutions, our economic institutions, our law enforcement institutions, our educational institutions tend to kind of reinforce that otherness and that sense of somehow disenfranchisement or disempowerment by reason of being different. And so those are powerful sources of suffering in our society, you know, and they really ask for our attention. They really call to us to say, yes, what's going on here? You know, how do we think of ourselves as being as the same as or different from? How do we think of others as being the same as or different from? In the San Francisco Bay Area, there has been recently formed a group called the East Bay Meditation Center. And some of the people, many of the people who are on the retreat also attend there. And it is a retreat center that was established in significant part to be a place of refuge for those who feel themselves to be different and to be disadvantaged thereby. So there are evenings there that are devoted to LGBT, etc. Communities. There are sitting nights that are devoted to people of color and others, other dimensions that create that otherness, that isolation, that separation, in order to do everything possible to lower whatever barriers may exist for people to experience the Dharma and to experience it in safe community. And that's the reason why at the beginning of our sitting this evening, you know, when I was on this retreat, I became, I think, more sensitized to the need for there to be a place of felt safety in order to practice the Dharma, in order for there to be a place where we literally have each other's back, where we are sort of here for each other. And it's for that reason this evening that I repeated the, you know, we chanted the precepts as well as the refuges, you know, because they form that that commitment. You know, we co-create this place of sanctuary for us to meet and practice the Dharma and to discuss it. And I came away from that retreat with a real appreciation of the importance of that in a way that I hadn't, you know, really come to before. And one of the African-American women who goes to these meditations, and we were talking about this, we were speaking in terms of Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And we recently contracted with a really fantastic facilitator, a woman named Nita Mosby Tyler, who's a former HR director for the city of Denver and for Children's Hospital. And she is a corporate consultant who does work in, she does workshops on diversity, equity, and social justice. And there was some, and we contracted with her, that, when I say we, I mean the Colorado Sierra Club, to do a training for the board of directors of the club. And we had a wonderful time kind of exploring these issues. And she talked about the Maslowian needs hierarchy a lot, you know, that first we need to just be fed and have shelter. Then we need to have our survival and security needs met. And then our needs for belongingness, okay? And our needs for esteem, both self-esteem and social esteem. And what the this yogi that I was, you know, in conversation with at the retreat was saying, well, you know, for many of us, people of color, in terms of meeting those needs, it's really important that we be able to be in a safe place. And in some cases, that means being with people who are like us, you know, instead of always feeling different or always feeling like a minority group member in society. It's really important just to be with others so we didn't feel outside, we didn't feel extra, we didn't feel different. You know, and that was true with regard to ethnic lineage, and it was certainly true with regard to those of us, you know, the primary purpose of the tree having to do with issues of gender and sexual orientation. And it, so for me, that was very eye-opening, and it helped me gain a broader perspective. It also reaffirmed in me the need to do everything we possibly can in this Sangha to make sure that even, you know, unconsciously, there are any kinds of aspects that have the effect of making somebody feel a little less welcome or a little different by reason of any of the dimensions I just got to talking about, you know. And I think there are ways that we can continue to awaken to what those barriers might be and work on them. But I think as a Sangha, it's really incumbent upon us to do what we can. And I think all of us who help make this thing run are completely open to discussion, to be educated, to be informed on how best to do that, and you know, even as I seek to do it with regard to gender identity. It also raised other questions for me in terms of basically social power, you know. Who gets to decide who's different? For the last 500 years or so in North America, it's been European Americans, you know, or the majority, you know, ethnic group. We are now demographically beginning to see, or we're seeing the beginning of the end of that era. You know, as the demographic shifts in American society take place. And that is proving to be disturbing and terrifying to some European Americans, you know, who recognize that position of cultural dominance is being questioned, that it's changing, that it arose, and it was, and that it now may very well be in the process passing away. How do we negotiate that shift? How do we do it in a way that's mutually supportive and welcoming and opening, instead of succumbing to the kind of really vitriolic, painful, dualistic discourse that seems to infect our politics right now and our social interactions. You know? And for me, it felt like it certainly called upon me, you know, as a student of the Buddhist teachings and a practitioner, to say, okay, what does the Dharma bring to this situation? How can we hold these dynamics around self and other? Who gets to identify who's different? Who gets to identify who is less? Who gets to identify to determine who has less power, social status, or standing? Same is true, you know, with regard to the role of status of women. You know, it, as the Me Too movement has grown and flourished and become stronger, but often gets lost is the fact that it started by an African American woman. And she was getting, you know, she was getting it from all sides, right? And she just said enough. You know, this isn't acceptable. This isn't how it's going to be anymore. And began to speak out. And so, you know, if you look at the basically the power structure in American society, it's gender-conforming European-American men for the most part, and not all of us, but some, who have been deciding who's different and who's not, and how they're going to be treated accordingly, and that's being called out. It's being called out as unjust and socially destructive, and something that needs to change. It's not a matter of whether it changes, it's a matter of how. What role can the Dharma play in helping bring that into being? Some peace officers, we used to call them, you know, police officers, some, not all, going way back in our history, have killed African Americans and Latin Americans and others at much higher rates than European Americans, and it's gone largely unquestioned. No more. The same thing is being called out. It's not right, it's not just, it's not acceptable, it has to change. It's not whether it's going to change, it's how it's going to change. And again, it brings us back to what does the Dharma have to say about that? How can we as individual practitioners of Buddha Dharma, how can we as a Sangha name that as a source of terrible social suffering and one that needs to change so that those words that are carved into the over the door of the building of the United States Supreme Court, equal justice under law, actually have meaning, you know? We can come to the point where we can actually live that, that can be our Dharma, you know, rather than just nice words on the marble building. So, difference, and how are we treated thereby, you know, as a result of being labeled. Who does the labeling? How is that? How is the disadvantageous aspects of that labeling enforced? These are questions of our time, but they are not only of our time. They were a very big deal in the Buddhist time. And so, as I was thinking about, you know, putting some remarks together this evening for us to kind of reflect on and talk about, I read up, you know, reread and read up a little bit more about what historians of Buddhism know about the Buddha's own Sangha, how it came into being, how it was structured, difference in the politics of difference played a huge role in the Buddha's founding of the original Buddha Dharma Sangha. And it was revolutionary and highly controversial at the time. He was born into a society that was structured in terms of a relatively rigid caste system. And there were different castes or strata in the social order that had different responsibilities in society. The caste he was born into was a ruling caste. You know, it was the people who were the monarchs and the administrators, the military leaders. There was a commercial class, you know, tradesmen and artisans and you know, bankers, I guess, and that the economy was really humming along during this time. There were the lower castes, the outcasts, even the ones that did the real scut work that nobody wanted to do. And the highest caste was the Brahmins. They were the priests of the state religion, Brahmanism and Hinduism. The Buddha, when he decided to walk away from the life he had been born to as a ruler and become a homeless wanderer, a recluse, and then achieved enlightenment and came back out of the bush and decided to start teaching. He had people coming to him from different walks of life. And he talks over and over and over again about the people who had come to him, people who were already living the holy life. He talks about them as being Brahmins and recluses. He uses that phrase over and over again, or Brahmins and ascetics. And that meant that there were a lot of people from the Brahmanic caste who had come to the conclusion that Brahmanism as it was being practiced was morally bankrupt. That it was kind of like the Catholic Church right before the Reformation, that people were having to fork over big bucks to the Brahmins to perform rituals and try to make sure that the people that were giving them all that money had a better crack at, you know, going on to be into the heavenly realms upon death or be reborn into a high status. And they had become kind of self-serving, and so a lot of the Brahmins were really quite disaffected. And so they started looking around to see who else seemed to be on their game, and they came across the Buddha, and many of them realized that the teachings that he was offering and the practices that he was offering were very much in line with the ideals that Brahmanism was supposed to be upholding, but wasn't. And so they left the priesthood and they joined the Buddha. So that was one big, you know, chunk of the people that became part of the Buddha Dharma Sangha. And the recluses were another, and that was who he had been, right? He hadn't been a Brahmin priest. So there were these two different groups of spiritual seekers that were in the Sangha. And then there were others, and this is where it got really pretty bouncy. Because what the Buddha decided is that he wanted his Sangha to consist not only of full-time spiritual seekers, but of anybody who wanted to explore why the mind creates suffering for itself and how it can be brought to an end. And so he invited people from all castes to come in, which for some of the Brahmins was a real bummer. You know, but the idea that there were going to be people to come in that used to scrub out their toilets, that all of a sudden we're now going to be able to be co-equals in his Sangha was kind of a non-starter. And so some of them peeled off, and the others decided they had to get with the program. He said, everybody that comes here, take off all your jewelry, take off anything that bespeaks a station in life, your fine clothing. What we do is we take recycled clothes and towels and sheets and things that people have thrown out, and we stitch them back together again, we take them down the riverbank, and we dye them in the muds that are available in the mud, or ochre colored and yellow colored. Those are the colors of the muds of the river center. That's where the color of their robes came from. So everybody, regardless of what caste they come from, looked the same. Nobody was higher than anyone else based on their station in life. There was differentiation that began to happen based upon their state of realization of the Buddha's teachings. That some, as they became more realized, also, you know, started to take on teaching roles. And that was the only, you know, that kind of spiritual, merit of spiritual maturity is the only organizing principle that he really had. So there is that one. And the untouchables. And the other thing about the ranking of the castes is that it's closely associated with skin color. The lighter skinned people tended to be the Shakyas and the Brahmins. The untouchables, for the most part, were extremely dark skinned. So there was that kind of prejudice going on in the extreme at that time, but it was having none of it. When he had these wealthy patrons that he'd go and give Dharma talks to, bring his retinue with him, and then when he was there, he got into this habit of kind of putting him on the spot. And he would say, you know, suppose that one of your untouchables, one of your slaves, came. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Suppose they came to you and said, oh, Master, I have heard the teachings of the Buddha, and I want to go forth into the homeless life to live my life in this impeccable way, to help bring suffering to an end for myself and all beings. Would you deny your slave the opportunity to do that? And these wealthy slave owners would all say, oh, no, no, great one, I would certainly release my slave to do that. So, bingo, all of a sudden a bunch of slaves start showing up in the summer, right? And their masters had kind of gotten shamed into letting them go. So, the Buddha was all about difference, and he was all about otherness. And he was all about trying to create as inclusive a sangha as possible. Except in one regard, having to do with, for many years into the Sangha, I guess it was, what, maybe 12, 15 or more, women were not allowed in. And the Buddha was disinclined to allow them in. And his kind of wingman, his attendant, and also over time, one of his more and more trusted wise advisors, Ananda, kept asking the Buddha, you know, why are there no women in the Sangha? Why cannot women enter the Sangha? And the Buddha gave different answers at different times, if the time was not right or whatnot, like we've all heard that before. You know? Martin Luther King heard that a lot in the 50s, right? And historians think that there, among the things that were going on, is that there was huge pushback from the Brahmins, you know, and because in Brahmanism, the way it worked is you kept going for higher and higher rebirths until you could get reborn as a Brahmin. And then, of course, in order to achieve full oneness with Brahma, you had to get born as a male Brahmin, right? And so there is that going on in the society. There's, you know, ranks of ordination of women already going on in Indian society, and they were real down on the idea. Evidently, one of the other things that was on the mind of the Buddha was that he didn't feel that his Sangha was yet morally cohesive enough to be able to guarantee their safety. He was evidently really quite concerned that once these women had come under his protection, she was responsible for their physical as well as their spiritual well-being, that he didn't know if the Sangha was going to really honor their safety. You know, things are evidently pretty rough there at first. His stepmother, who he had given teachings to, who became very wise, became a very skilled teacher himself, would repeatedly ask the Buddha, you know, may we admit them into your Sangha? And he kept turning her down. And he had actually been the cause of a lot of the problems the women in his province were suffering. There had been a terrible war going on between these two different tribes within the kingdom, and he had gone down there and he had managed to negotiate a peace between them. And these men, the farmers, warriors, were so taken with the Buddha's presence and his teachings, they all left home and became monks. And they walked out on their families just like he had done. So she had that to deal with, and so all these women started coming to her. The Buddha actually had a harem of about 12 women. He walked out on them, and when he did that, they had nowhere to turn. And so there were a lot of women who were actually suffering by reason of, you know, what the Buddha was up to. And his stepmom kept, you know, coming at him about that. And he kind of turned a deaf ear. And all these women were coming to her. And so she had this sangha of women going that she was teaching. And they were so sincere in wanting to be part of the Buddha Dharma Sangha that they got together and they hiked 500 miles together to where the Buddha Sangha was established. And they said, we entreat you to admit us to the Sangha. And when the Buddha saw the depth of their dedication, the amount of suffering they'd gone through, and he looked around at some of the people in his own Sangha, and really kind of doubted they would have been equal to such a thing. So that's the point in which women came into the Sangha. So it took a while, but it happened, right? Which was relatively unheard of at that time. That's just not how the game was played. So he also eventually went head-on into that realm of discriminatory otherness and overruled it. The deal going in, however, was that the most senior and wisest nun was always going to be junior to the most junior monk. Okay. And unfortunately, that's still how things are ordered in traditional monastic settings in Southeast Asia, which is one of the reasons why when my own root Western teachers had come back from Asia, where they had spent years as monks or nuns with people like Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Buddhadasa in Thailand, or Mahasi Sayadaw in Burma and his lineage. But when they came back, they decided to disrobe, to cease to be monastics, and to teach from a lay perspective, because they had profound respect for the teachings in terms of how they had transformed their own lives, and they knew that it could have the same transformative effect on us, but they did not want to bring some of the cultural, institutional traditions that they felt would only perpetuate suffering in our society rather than bring it to an end. That being said, of course, we do have traditional Theravada monastics in the West, you know, here in the United States, in England, elsewhere in Europe, and including orders of nuns that have been recently established and they're now coming into being here and there. So it's an ongoing process, but what I'm talking about in terms of us deep dealing with difference in a compassionate and outgoing and open-hearted way is only the latest iteration of a dynamic that's been going on since the day the Buddha began to teach, and will no doubt continue to go on in the future. So, as far as my thinking and reflection has gone, I'd really appreciate it if we could spend some time in conversation about any of the points that I raised that may have touched something in you that you would like to comment on or maybe ask a question about. Please.
Once again, you know, I'm going to play the devil's advocate.
Please, that's what makes it fun.
But a few months ago, Solwazi Johnson, yeah, who is a Dharma teacher in our lineage,
yes,
and who happens to be black,
mm-hmm,
gave a retreat at the Evanston Center. And several of us were there, actually. And what struck me about it was the fact that there were lots of people of color at that retreat.
Yes.
And what strikes me about our Sangha is that there are no people of color, or almost.
No, there are several, but you know, obviously, you know,
yeah,
not the majority. Yeah.
So I had coffee with Solwazi a month or so ago, and we talked about that. And somehow, in all my years of Dharma practice, the situation has not changed. You know, Solwazi does a much different kind of retreat. It's not just a silent, traditional Vipassana retreat. There's music, there's movement, there's, you know, noisemakers, and all kinds of stuff. And I'm just wondering, you know, I'm reminded of what Jesse Jackson said about 11 o'clock Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in American life.
Martin Luther King said that.
Oh, was that okay?
Yeah.
And so here we are, nothing really seems to have changed from our side.
Well, there are about a half a dozen people of color here tonight, so let's not speak in absolutes.
Okay.
You're mostly behind you.
Sorry. But you know what I'm saying.
In terms of balance, it's absolutely true.
Yeah, and you could really see it at Solwazi's retreat. You know, there was a definite mix there.
Yeah.
And it was refreshing.
Right.
It was wonderful to be there.
Yeah, I would love for us to be able to, you know, do more of the same thing ourselves. And so that's why, you know, open to suggestions about how that might come about. Please.
So I kind of mentioned.
And your name is?
I'm Casey.
Yeah.
So I kind of mentioned this. Someone was here about using the phrase people of color. I really, not just objective, I find it difficult to listen to.
Yes.
The phrase was coined in the 70s before I had my kids. And at that time I'm thinking, oh my God, does it include Asians? I'm okay with it now, but at that time, okay, so how do I tell my kids that they're people of color? You know, at 6, 7, it was too young, 10, still too young. High school, they're like coming to their own. I thought they should make their own discovery, so I never had the chance to tell them. And I wanted to, but I didn't know how to approach it. And I think just in the last month, I don't tear up anymore when I talk about it. But, I mean, what is that? That's just like a gentrified way of saying colored people.
Yes.
Just putting the adjective in front of, I don't know, you know, switching around with a preposition in the middle. I mean, if we're going to be called people of color, then the opposite of that might be colorless people. So I might prefer to be called colorful people versus, I don't know, yeah. So it just serves to perpetuate the
division.
Yeah, the division.
It's a polarizing discourse.
Right, right. It just doesn't make sense. And I just find it really offensive.
Thank you.
And the young people, if you hear them in the poetry, they call themselves brown people or black people. You know, they don't call them, we're people of color. That's really convoluted.
Yes.
And there's, you know, it wasn't coined by anthropologists or linguists or colorists. You know, I have architectural background. I know about color. It's, it has nothing to do with color. I mean, even, I think I said it last time, I just don't know, like, I'm getting headache, but I need to say this. Just say a flower, their most salient attributes are color and fragrance.
Yes.
But even a five-year-old doesn't refer to a rose and or a daffodil or a daisy as a yellow flower. They kind of already know there's more to the flower than the color. You know, so.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much. I ran into that headlong on this retreat. And I was really struck by the difference in discourse from what was going on in that retreat, from, you know, the trainings I helped organize and we got from Anita Mosby Tyler. The teachings there was about 50% introductory dharma and 50% East Bay identity politics. and it was incongruous and weird for me, because when they were talking about, you know, the Buddhist teachings about openness to difference and all the variations around gender identity and sexual orientation, it was so warm and welcoming, everyone coming. And then when he switched over and started talking about race and ethnicity, the discourse became extremely binary and really pretty polarizing. You know, and as a European American man, you know, one of the Dharma teachers is going through the hierarchy of privilege. You know, who is the least privileged and who is the most privileged, and essentially the way she was laying it out, I basically been indicted as a member of the oppressive class, you know, by reason of, you know, gender and ethnicity. In those discourses, when they would talk about Asian Americans and African Americans and Latin Americans and white people, for me, that was a form of microaggression. They're saying, like, white people are without color and without culture. It's not true. European Americans, the only white people, actually, are albinos, you know. European Americans, for the most part, are kind of a pinkish beige, you know. And the color depends on who your ancestors were and how much time you spent in the sun. And so, and certainly in the work we're doing this, Tyler, we're realizing that, you know, white people and people of color is a polarizing discourse. And when she was leading our thing, she was saying, you know, European Americans, she should use the term, you know, white people a fair amount, but European Americans are just as instrumental in our definition of diversity and how we live together as a diverse society as anybody else. That it's really essential, especially in these times, that we have equal and deep respect for and a desire to learn more about each other's cultural lineage. That to focus only on the color of skin, you know, Martin Luther King said that. He said, I have a dream of a day when, you know, we will be judged not by the color of our skin, but by the content of our character. And it takes a while to get to know this content of somebody's character, whatever their ethnic lineage happens to be. And so I, for the most part, have really started to move away from talking about, you know, even though I did it tonight, you know, some white people and people of color, because I think that discourse is actually doing more harm than good. I think that if we are going to really move forward together as mutually supportive communities to get beyond the terrible racial strife that's actually being fomented by people in our society, that we need to do it in a way that kind of has a hard look at ways that our language might be making matters worse or at least keeping things from getting better. And so I'm very appreciative of what you said, that it, maybe we really need to start focusing our attention on how to find means of using language that express our intent of mutual respect and mutual support, of providing places of safety for each other, regardless of what our background is. And that we need not to just think about this stuff, but to act on it.
Can I just add one other thing? So when I was in grad school, there was like a kind of a prince with his entourage, and they're sitting in front of the computer and saying, "So, look at this people of color. Are we a people of color? I don't feel, you know, put down by my society." So they were very confused about this concept. And then for me, my parents travel a lot, so I grew up in a lot of different countries, mostly in Australia. And for me, I've grown up kind of, I felt like I was kind of part of the United Nations. My mom worked for the United Nations too. So it's kind of a new concept that I have to, understand that this is how it is, in, at least in America, and then now it's gone overseas. There was one last thing I was going to say. I can't remember. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing what you did. It definitely opened up some new business for us. Please, any other?
There's, and this is all really important and critical. I mean, our government's our leader is going in the opposite direction.
Yes.
But there's another huge population that's stigmatized and on the out, the mentally ill. Mm-hmm. And all you have to do is go by the mission. Now, mentally ill also means alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
And so all those people on the street, to one degree or another, are mentally ill. And the stigma...
Different. Right. Yes. Whether it's a mental disability or a physical disability, it is a, you know, is a powerful and destructive force of othering of difference. Right. Something else to be woken up to.
And so they're closing down the camps and driving people into Commerce City, basically.
And they started closing down state mental hospitals in the 1970s. The idea was that there was going to be all this funding to create community-based centers where people could get treatment, where they could get medications, where they could be integrated into the community. Well, all they really did was shut down the state hospitals and dump people on the streets. And so instead of just warehousing everybody, basically incarcerating them out of sight, now they're on the street, but we're not taking collective responsibility for them in a way that we ought to be. There's one other thing I wanted to touch on, which is that when things really, you know, there was so much that went on toward the end of that retreat that I began to have problems with around the, you know, they kept coming back to the notion of white privilege. It is absolutely, critically necessary that those of us in European American society are unaware of the extent to which institutions are being administered in ways that are manifestly unfair and that are continuing to oppress people who are not European Americans. We recognize that it be stood up against and that it be changed. That being said, when I do a lot of work down in the neighborhoods of Boatville area in Swansea and Southern Adams County around the Suncor refinery and the Superfund site and the expansion of I-70 on behalf of the Sierra Club, and wind down that neighborhood, the European American people who live there, okay, are breathing the same carcinogenic air as their Chicano natives, or neighbors, you know. They may be working two or three jobs to make ends meet, none of which have any benefits or health care. They make just a little bit too much money to qualify for Medicaid. And so you start talking to them about white privilege, and it somehow doesn't compute. That discourse is trying to get at something that's critically important, but the way that it's going about doing it is absolutely deaf to notions of class, you know. And in terms of othering, in terms of those who are different, people who do not have adequate means to get their kids a decent education and find decent housing, whatever their ethnic lineage, are likewise being seriously oppressed. It's yet another source of institutionalized social suffering that, yet again, the Dharma has a role to play in bringing to an end. So we've just begun this conversation. I have no doubt we'll continue it in times to come. Meanwhile, we've gobbled up another two perfectly good hours. I hope we feel it was well spent. Take our sitting postures again just for 1 minute. I want to give us a little blessing going out on behalf of the Devas, whether you consider them to be celestial beings or our own collective superconscious, helping each other out from the heavenly realms. Bhavatu Sava Mangala Prakatu Sava Deva. May there be every blessing. May all the Devas protect you. Sava Buddha Nubhavina Sava Sadeva Bhante. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakhantu Sava Devanta. May there be every blessing. May all the Devas protect you. Sava Dhamma Nubhavina Sava Sandeva Bhante. By the power of all the Dhammas, may you always be well. Sava Dhamma Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devanta. May there be every blessing. May all the Devas protect you. Sava Sangha Nubhavina. By the power of all this Sangha, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devanta. May there be every blessing. May all the Devas protect you. Safe.